and welcome to episode 229 of Effect, Critical Thinking. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew, and we have a packed program for you in this episode.
We always say that anyway.
We do always say that because, you know, it's like us saying it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from him.
It's just entirely pointless content that pads out the length of the podcast. Yeah.
Stop padding out the length of the podcast. Honestly, we've got enough content. We don't need sides like this to get to the full hour or over the hour.
No, indeed.
Where are we? Well, our content does include an Old West update, which is now a regular feature. For this podcast, and will be until we have released Tales of the Old West. We've also got plenty of news in the world of gaming, including a project that we haven't talked about much, Dave, but one that you have worked on. So I'm kind of interested to hear about that.
Indeed.
And frankly, I feel really crazy new Year Zero engine game that I might just have to buy just because of its craziness. Then we have got an essay where the long promised episode comparing all the critical tables of the various Free League Year Zero games. I didn't go into War Stories, Dave. That's a whole different mechanic.
And that's true, yeah.
And that became a bit of a search to find what is the deadliest Free League Year Zero game. The answer will surprise you.
clickbait.
That is our clickbait. You gotta stay listening to the end now to find out what the answer is.
It's a bit like when you see see something online on television where it says, could it be that such and such and such a... Well, obviously, if they say, could it be, the answer is always...
It isn't.
No, of course it can't be. Don't be fucking stupid. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
So the other thing we ought to say is we have no new patrons to thank today, but... Thank you to all our existing patrons.
Indeed.
We love you all.
We do.
You make this possible. I can't remember whether we've already mentioned this, but we did our annual fee to our hosting providers. I might have mentioned this And, you know, that can't happen without the support of our patrons. So thank you all.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Right then, moving on to the Old West update. So, exciting news. We've been working on the quick draw rules for the last few weeks. The text is finished, edited, off to the layout artist, which is superb. The maps are pretty much done, if not actually done. The artwork is coming along very nicely, and there are some fabulous pictures coming along from our artist, Malin. And
superb was the word you used on one of them.
It was. Yeah. And that is a superb picture. It's exactly what I was kind of thinking when I suggested it. And it looks really good. So, yeah, that's great. That's coming along. It's all on schedule, which is brilliant because we need to have it done within the next month to make sure we can get it ready for UK Games Expo. But, yeah, that's great. I'm really pleased how well it's gone. I also got back... feedback, which I don't think you were copied into, Matt, from our friend Saul. Giving us the sort of Mexican Spanish perspective on everything we've done, and yeah, he was very very positive about it. He made a couple of comments about some of the Mexican naming conventions, but
I was wondering if he would,
but actually. only for information. He wasn't sort of saying that he felt we ought to change it. Basically cool. Saying that the Mexicans would often have a lot of names. They would often take the father and the mother's name. They would have a middle name and they'd have a first name. So there's a lot of names for many Mexicans or Spanish, I assume. But yeah, great to know that.
Saul had told me before that a lot of Mexicans of Spanish descent like to map in their name, map their heritage all the way back to Spain.
Absolutely.
Or something like that, I seem to remember. Yeah.
And with obviously a great deal of pride in that heritage and therefore in their family names. But he was happy. He said he loved the names I'd chosen. He thought they were The meaning of the names was really relevant, which was great. And
I
did kind of intend that mostly. There might have been one name I threw in there that I hadn't quite realised the meaning, but the meaning of it is brilliant. we talked about the term Chibolero.
Because we had a bit of a discussion about whether there was a feminine form of that as well.
So actually, interestingly, Saul had never heard the term, which actually isn't necessarily unsurprising, because Chibolero is a very specific term for a specific, you know, a buffalo hunter, Mexican buffalo hunter, specifically at that time. So it's not a word that's in use now. It was not a word that was in use before. It was only
any buffaloes to hunt nowadays.
Well, indeed, but it's not a word that's come down in some other form. Mm. So that was great. But he suggested that we could, for one of our characters who's a female Chibolero, he said...
One of
our non-player characters.
Because
we were wondering whether it should be Chibolera or Chibolero. Mm. And he said, well, you know, technically it could be Chibolera, but Chibolero would be absolutely fine. So for simplicity's sake, I've decided to stick with Chibolero. But that was great.
I think that sounds great.
So we had lots of feedback. Neil did a great job editing. Really, really good job. Contributed loads to the text. So thanks very much for his very thorough and very expert work for us.
He is a professional editor.
He is.
Yeah.
And you can tell. So that was great. So that's the quick draw. Other things that we've been doing.
Before we go on the quick draw, we've mentioned Saul, we've mentioned Neil. Just wanted to give a shout out to Nick Brook, who is doing our layout for us.
Yes.
And Nick Brook is, I've got to admit, not a professional layout artist, but he has done a lot for a huge chunk of all the publications in the Johnstown Compendium, which is the equivalent of the Free League Workshop for RuneQuest. Mm-hmm. So he's a very experienced layout artist, and I'm sure he's going to do a great job for us.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Okay. And it was great of Nick to agree to do this for us. That was fabulous. Thank you. So the other thing, in terms of the rules and stuff, so I've been doing a bit of work sort of reviewing some of the things we wanted to look at. In the quick draw, I'd slightly changed the horse rules, which I think was an improvement, so I've just worked through that for the core book.
In the main book.
I've kind of gone over the chasing and the manhunt rules again and made a few minor changes, but not loads, but it simplified slightly, made it a bit kind of easier to grasp, I think. So I think that works. That should work really well.
Simplify slightly is generally what I always tell you to do. So even though I haven't seen those changes yet, I'm confident I will approve them.
Yeah, I mean, the main simplification, I mean, actually on the manhunt rules, I think the manhunt rules were pretty good and work quite well. So they haven't really been changed very much. The chase rules, I think the one problem I had with the chase rules was grappling with the idea that I wanted one set of rules that would work for any kind of chase, for a horse race, horse chase, foot chase, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
That led to kind of range tables that didn't, not that they didn't make sense, they did make sense, but they weren't consistent. So the ranges were different if you're on a horse and if you're on a person. So what I've done is I've got rid of all of that. You now have, you just use the basic ranges that you have in the game, which makes more sense. Mm-hmm. And you get a modification. So if you are on horseback and you are chasing a man on foot, you'll get bonus dice to your animal handling roll in chasing down the guy on foot. So it's simplified in that sense. So I think that works quite well.
Cool.
So I've been doing things like that. I've now moved on to writing the campaign chapter. I've written about a third of that so far.
Cool.
And that's cool. I think that's coming along nicely. It's the way I want to do it is, it's complicated is the wrong word. But I want to make use of all the material that we've created. So I want to be able to draw in Steaming Rock and Carson's Folly from the introductory scenarios for the quick draw and for the book into the wider New Mexico campaign setting. Because we've got that stuff there. We might as well use it if the GMs want to use it. So it's trying to draw that into an overall kind of framework with Uinta Springs as the kind of the recommended key location. But actually, I want to do it so that if the GM wants to set it in Steaming Rock because his players liked it having run that game, or Carson's Folly for the same reason, that you can actually do that. So we'll see how it is. Obviously, I'll let you know when I finished it and you can have a read and see if I succeed in that aspiration.
And also the other thing, you know, about the different settlements is they're of different sizes and different states of development and things like that. They can be an indicator to you if you want to make, as a GM or as a group, you want to do your own town. You've now got more examples to pull from in thinking what your settlement could be.
Yeah, absolutely. And each of them is kind of subtly different because they're set in different places. They're located in different places in the state. So the reason for them existing is different. So, you know, Yonada Springs is in the Rio Grande River Valley. So it's much to do with cattle and horse ranching.
Farming.
That's what you're doing there. It's next to some mountains, so there might be some mining interest going on, but it's principally a ranching town. Steaming Rock is set kind of in the Gila Mountains on the southwestern side. That's principally going to be timber, but also mining interest there. And then you've got Carson's Folly up in the north. It started out as a trading post and a hunting camp.
Yeah.
So obviously there's a lot of hunting and stuff around that.
So my impression is that Carson's Folly is the smallest of the three in terms of population.
It probably is, yeah.
Haven't played in there.
Not by much, yeah. I guess, but yeah. It's still more of a camp than a town almost.
Yeah.
But yeah. So all that's happening at the moment. The other thing I was going to mention is we've been thinking about some of the other things we need to do over the next few weeks, like how do we go about advertising and marketing what we're doing and getting people out there. So I've spoken to a couple of people about trying to use their Western Reconstruction towns as a backdrop for us to do things like videos and stuff. So I haven't got an answer yet on any of that, but I am making progress. So I spoke to a guy who runs a Wild West LARPing thing. I'm not sure if he runs it, but he's certainly involved in the organisation of it. A Wild West LARP called The Good, The Bad and The Dead, which just this last weekend had one of their weekend LARPing sessions. And they obviously run it in a town, which I think is called Deadwood, but they don't own
it. I believe that is their name, yes.
Yeah. They don't own it. They rent it off the owners. So he's going to put me in touch with the people who own it, and that I can talk to them and see if we can come to an arrangement where we can come along and just spend a couple of hours recording some videos in a authentic location. And, you know, we can obviously promote them as well. So there's lots of little bits and bobs going on, all making progress in the right direction, it feels.
Yeah.
So it's been a good couple of weeks.
Cool, cool, cool. Right. So that's our little world of gaming going on there. What's happening in the wider world of gaming? I have noticed your name attached to a project that might excite a bunch of people. Do you want to tell us more?
Indeed. So Planet of the Apes role-playing game. I joined the team for that a year ago, I guess now, and had the opportunity to work on some of the material for it. It's a game that's based on the old movies and the old movies only. So it's the five movies from back in the 70s. So obviously starting with Planet of the Apes, and then you've got, or if I can remember them all, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Battle of the Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and another one, I think. So I got to work on some of that, doing sort of setting material and scenario and campaign sort of backgrounds. They announced that literally 3 days ago that, finally, I think there's been a lot of negotiation with the IP holders about how it's going to be managed. So it's been a long process getting there, but finally they've obviously got to the point where they can announce it. And they did that. And say, I think the cover art, the art picture that they've put on looks very reminiscent of I think Battle of the Planet of the Apes, but it looks very cool with apes on horses with a sort of orange golden background sunshine behind them. So it's using the D6 system from the old Star Wars, West End Games Star Wars system, the system that Drew Gasker and Eric Thomas used in Carbon Grey, that was also produced by them and Magnetic Press. So this is a Magnetic Press game with obviously Drew and Eric are kind of the leading designers and writers.
Cool. Who's Eric? Do I know Eric?
Eric Thomas. So he's a game designer of kind of like long repute. He's been writing stuff for a long time. But he and Drew kind of came together to do Carbon Grey.
And oh, right.
Eric is a kind of like Drew's partner in crime for putting Planet of the Apes together. And a great guy, really nice chat. I really much enjoyed chatting with him. But yeah, cool. So I'm not sure there's much else for me to say. I think my work on the game is done. But it'd be interesting to see how it does. I mean, it's an interesting... I mean, it's one of those things that... it's an IP that people are big fans of. I mean, it carries... I was using the phrase nostalgizing. So I think people nostalgize yes. a lot over Planet of the Apes. And I mean, if you...
Nostalgizing isn't a word.
It is now, though, because I've used it and people understand what I mean. So it's a word. It might not be in the dictionary. I haven't checked.
It definitely isn't in the dictionary. I've looked.
Have you? Okay, fair enough. It will be soon if we use it often enough. And actually, I think if you go back, I mean, obviously the original Planet of the Apes movie was superb, groundbreaking of its time. You've got some performances in all of the movies, particularly like the likes of Roddy McDowell, who I absolutely love. I could watch Roddy McDowell in anything and I would enjoy it.
As long as he's in an ape mask.
Not even that. No. He's
he does other things as well, but he's particularly good in an ape mask.
But I think actually some of the other movies back from then don't come up to the standard of the original.
No, definitely.
So
it's an interesting example of an early sort of franchise where they, you know, they had the IP and, you know, they tried to make loads of movies and a TV series famously out of it and to really push at the boundaries of what the setup could do when, if you like, the punchline of, oh my God, it's Earth, you know, that's gone in the first series. And that was part of the groundbreaking nature of Planet of the Apes. And,
completely.
And then,
you're,
spoilers, by the way. Sorry. Anybody who hasn't seen Planet of the Apes. It's not a different planet at all.
If you haven't seen Planet of the Apes by now, then you deserve to get it spoiled, I'm afraid. So it probably means you're not that interested.
And I guess we should also point out that this is Roddy McDowell, Planet of the Apes, not Andy Serkis, Planet of the Apes, which is an entirely different IP. So not part
so,
of
the... So the role-playing game does not cover the modern movies, no.
No. And I guess it doesn't cover what I like to think of as Helena Bonham Carter fringe acting Planet of the Apes either.
No, it doesn't cover that, no. I mean, there were some good things in that movie. Tim Roth.
Which one?
Thought was
the Helena Bonham Carter?
I think that was the one with
Name
Tim Roth,
one. Go on. Name one.
Well, was that the one with Tim Roth in it? Tim Roth played the nasty bad ape. Well, whichever film it was. It was the one between them. It was the one that came like 15 years ago or whatever before they rebooted it again with the Andy Serkis movies.
Yeah.
The good thing about that movie was Tim Roth was brilliant. Again, he's one of those actors that I can watch just about anything. And that's probably it, actually. The ending of that movie, when the pod was coming down, spoilers again, but actually, frankly, it's a shit movie. So if you haven't seen it, don't bother. it's got this pod coming down at the end and there's some kind of like messiah, divine ape thing that everyone was worshipping. And I was just going, don't have the ape in it. Don't have the ape in it. Don't, for fuck's sake, have the ape. I'll fuck the apes in it. It was just so stupid. Oh, it's just, Hollywood at its worst for story writing. Absolute garbage. Anyway, digression.
Anyway, shall we move on from Planet of the Apes and the various iterations thereof? Because there is a second iteration of the Laundry Files role-playing game, which I thought was worth a mention. And I can't really remember why.
Yeah, this isn't something that's really come across my radar, so you're on your own with this one, mate.
Okay, so the Laundry Files is originally a set of novels by Charles Stross about a government branch of our intelligence services called the Laundry, wherein they deal with Cthulhu-esque incursions. And originally, of course, there was a Call of Cthulhu licensed version of that from Cubicle 7 when they had a license to do a whole bunch of stuff with Call of Cthulhu branding. So the Laundry Files was originally that. Then at some point Cubicle 7 gave up or lost the license. I'm not entirely sure about the politics around that. And so, of course, that meant they couldn't sell the Laundry Files anymore. It's not my thing at all. The setting's not my thing. The closest thing that is my thing that I love is, of course, Rivers of London, which we have talked about in episodes passim, which isn't Cthulhu-esque at all, but is kind of workaday English investigators of the supernatural. But Cubicle 7 have brought out have announced a new version of the Laundry Files with now nothing to do with BRP or Call of Cthulhu. It's got their own system, which I think they call the C7D6 system.
Okay.
It's a bit like Year Zero.
Dice pool, is it?
You have a dice pool, and your dice pool is kind of, attribute plus skill type dice pool, plus gear, I think. Sixes are successes, but there's a target number, so sometimes right. It can be fours, fives, and sixes, and slightly smaller dice pool, but because there's a target number that's lower than six, very often probably a little bit more chance of success.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to say about the Laundry Files, but I just thought it was worth mentioning because, I don't know, it came up in discussion at some point.
Okay, is that up on Kickstarter at the moment then? Has that just been kickstarted?
Oh, I don't know. I think it may have been announced, but not yet on Kickstarter. But we should look out for it if you're interested. I will either put a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter if it is, or I will put a link to the announcement if that's what we saw. There will be, or there is on Kickstarter, Lex Arcana, a supplement for Lex Arcana, which is all about Rome, which I thought would interest you, Dave, and also about Atlantis, which doesn't exist.
I'm aware of Lex Arcana. I've never played it. Again, it falls into the category of games.
Rome's interesting enough on its own. Why have monsters?
Yes. Thank you for finishing my sentence for me. Yeah.
It's only because I've heard it so often.
I know. So I've never looked into it. I haven't bought it. I haven't played it. So I've heard some good things from a number of people about it. But again, it's one of those that obviously that they felt Rome on its own wasn't sufficiently entertaining or interesting. So let's chuck in mystical, magical elements. But yeah, so I'm not.
Well, I have played it, and I will say it's got lovely art. The books are lovely, like loads of role-playing games that come out of Italy. They do a good job on that side.
Yeah.
The mechanics, when you look at them on paper, they take a lot of getting your head around.
Mm.
But actually, and I think they take a lot of getting your head around, actually, even at the table. Mm. But when you get your head around them, they're amazingly intuitive. And they kind of rely on you effectively gambling dice. You've got a stat, but how you create your dice pool out of that stat can either be more chance of a basic success or less chance of a basic success, but more chance of a critical. So there's a little bit of doing that, which you think is going to be terribly clumsy at the table, but when you get into it, you just get into it.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that makes me think a little bit about how sometimes the platonic ideal of a system is, I want the system to get out of the way of the game. I don't want to think about the system when I'm in the world I'm in.
Yeah.
But in this one, with this gambling thing, there's a bit of a There's actually fun in playing the game, and the mechanics draw you into the world.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think it's not a game I'd invest money or time in myself, but it is one that I can heartily recommend if you're at all interested in it. And
I wouldn't mind maybe picking up a PDF or something and having a quick look at it. But again, it's probably not something I'd run.
I think it might be worth it because I'm not the Roman historian out of the two of us, but what is the word I'm looking for? I'm trying now desperately not to make any noises, or I'm trying to think of the word. And I'm going to turn this around. So in the scenario that I've played in, I've played in just one adventure, I think over a number of sessions, and broadly it was about werewolves. But the setting, the authentic Roman setting around which these werewolves were in, was very, in my view, authentic, given I know less about Roman history than you do. And the Roman politics and stuff like that was of more interest, actually, if you like, than the monster. The monsters were deadly, and, you know, we lost a player character quite early on in the adventure because werewolves are pretty tough to beat. It works really well, and I would recommend that you at least pick up a PDF and have a look through it.
And it's interesting, as a little aside, you talking about games that are difficult to, you know, have got a front-loaded effort to actually get a grasp of. I had Rain arrive a few weeks ago, which I think I mentioned on an episode a little while ago. And it's sitting, since then, it's been sitting in my living room waiting for me to pick it up when I've got a spare few minutes to sit on the sofa and have a read. And I've been doing that, but I'm finding it really hard to kind of grasp the system. And it's the one roll system, where you have kind of the width of your roll is how many duplicate numbers you get on your dice pool. Mm. And the depth of your roll is how high those duplicates are. And I'm sure once you get it to the table and play it a bit, it'll be as second nature as anything. But just getting it to that point is feeling quite cumbersome.
That's another one that I've played, and it is actually really intuitive. They call it the one roll engine because really it is one roll. So,
exactly.
And those can interpret different things. How quickly do you do something? How much damage you do when you hit a person.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is actually great. But that's another one, I think, where the fun of the mechanics of the game actually draw you into the game. I can't speak to Rain, but one of the games that I am desperate to bring to the table, actually, and I think there may be a new version of it coming out sometime soon, which if it does come out, if it is announced soon, I'll make a big thing of, is Godlike.
Yes.
Where you play actually relatively ungodlike, relatively low powered superheroes in the Second World War. I really like that system. Mm. I can't remember what it was I played. I think I played Wild Talents, which is superheroes in a more traditional superhero setting, modern day. I think it's a good system. I like that system. Mm. Now, where are we? We've gone a little bit off the running order here. I can't remember.
Well, the next thing on the list is The Savage World of Solomon Kane. Announced by Monolith.
This was an interesting story because we saw the announcement. One of our patrons brought it to the table, and I thought, oh, young Dave is going to be doing some more work for Monolith shortly. I wonder if this is the secret game he hasn't told me about. But it turns out not to be the secret game you haven't told me about, Dave, doesn't it?
I'm not working on Solomon Kane, no. And I think this is, as I understand it, a translation of a French version into English, I think, something like that.
Yeah, so it strikes me that, obviously, Dave and I... Our listeners may be aware, we play Solomon Kane in one of our private games.
We do.
Run by our friend Andy. We will never record it because, let us say, Solomon Kane has a theme of redemption And so we're playing some pretty terrible characters in it.
Yeah.
Say no more. So you'll never hear us play Savage Worlds of Solomon Kane. It's based on Savage Worlds, which is a system, a pulpy sort of system that is, again, it's another one actually slightly that may be a little bit harder work than you think it's going to be when you start. And I think
it has elements to it that can be troublesome. I think it can be fun sapping, but
the shaken rules.
Yeah, particularly. Yeah. But actually, the games we've played that's been an issue once or twice, but not consistently, not a big problem.
Yes, it does. So there's some marvellous things. My character is a bit of a swordsman, and effectively, I get a bonus if I stand and tell people how good I am before, thereby letting them attack me first.
And how bad they are in many different ways.
Yeah, let's not go there. Let's not go there. It encourages that sort of behavior. So yeah, it's a good system. I think the shaken rules are a problem, and also I think sometimes when you get into being magical, the powers can feel a bit samey, but we're generally not magical in this game anyway. I think Monolith basically translated that into French, or Monolith's parents company, or sometime a few years ago they took the English language version of Solomon Kane, translated into French. Since then, they have acquired the gaming rights to Solomon Kane in general, I believe. And Pinnacle Entertainment, who did the English version, lost those rights. And I think the way I'm looking at it, they're thinking, well, we'll just translate those back into English, or maybe even use the original English version, but with all our new French artwork, and particularly our
mini range
miniatures.
So that'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. That's up on Kickstarter from, well, it's only a week according to Kickstarter, 15th to the 22nd of May.
Right.
Unless that is their range of when they're going to be starting the project.
Yeah, or maybe they're just planning a really short one.
It might be a short one, yeah.
You know, it's not like they need to pay for any of the work. They've done the work.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got a bunch of assets, I guess, they're going to package together into a new English version. And
Bob's your uncle.
Put out there, yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
I don't know how I feel about... So there are certain things in Solomon Kane that I really would change if I was doing a second edition. But I think overall I'd recommend it to anybody that might be interested in that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised. I mean, when Andy first talked about doing Solomon Kane campaign, I didn't really know anything about it. And I was like, well, yeah, if Andy wants to do it, fine, but I don't really know what I'm letting myself in for. And but it's great. I've really enjoyed it. The setting is really cool. I've enjoyed our little group of characters and the kind of like, you know, nasty people that, or at least two of us are anyway. Tony's character is actually kind of the nice one out of all of us.
Relatively vanilla. I have no idea what he's redeeming himself for.
No idea. But I've really enjoyed it, and I've loved the setting, and actually say the rules themselves are fine. They haven't got in the way. So a couple of occasions where, you know, over the long period we've been playing it, where we had, you know, the repeated stun, what do you call it again? Can't remember what the name of it is now. But basically you get stunned, you recover from being stunned, but by the time you recover from being stunned, you get stunned again. So you're basically taken out of a fight for good, which is a bit boring as a player. But that hasn't happened very often. So I probably won't back it. I don't have enough. I'm not going to run it myself. But actually, as a game system and a setting, it's really cool. I've had my eyes opened to how good Solomon Kane actually is.
Yeah, and it was interesting. So some years ago, Andy and I were chatting over something, and he was thinking about getting Deadlands and running that. He wanted a new role-playing game. And I thought Solomon Kane would be more up his street. And Deadlands is also, well, there are a couple of versions, but the modern version of Deadlands is Savage Worlds. And I thought, actually, no, Andy, I know you. I know you better than you think you You think you know yourself. You'd like Solomon Cain more. And I think it's really up and Andy Street. And we're playing it again this weekend, aren't we? I think, coming.
We are. Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, he seems to be enjoying it. It's good fun. I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's cool. Good luck
to Monolith. So, finally then. Finally, the new Year Zero game is now... I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm only saying that because I can't remember who it's from. But it is called Elder Mythos.
Okay.
And what you do is you use the Year Zero engine to play not just people fighting Cthulhu, because, you know, that's been done. There are more than one system that has you fighting Cthulhu. This gives you the opportunity to... be Cthulhu.
Okay.
On a dice pool of four stats. I'm really intrigued. I'm going to have to buy this to see how it works. But I have to say, if I was starting a game from the principle of you are the Elder Gods, I'm not sure that the Year Zero engine is the system I'd start with.
Yeah. So it's by a company called Mana Project Studio. I haven't heard of them before. They've got 10 days left to go on their Kickstarter for it, and they've smashed their goal already. They're way past that with 1,000 backers. Good stuff. Well done them. Yeah, it's a... I don't know. I mean, everywhere I look, there's another game that's basically Cthulhu. In another form or another skin or another setting, and there seems to be almost an unending enthusiasm from players for it. I wonder when the well of Cthulhu will run dry. It doesn't seem to be yet, but it's an interesting one, isn't it?
I'm kind of more interested to see how they've adapted the mechanics of the Year Zero engine to fit than I ever will be in playing it, because I don't think They're going to have to stun me with some pretty amazing mechanics to make me go, I want to pick this up. But I'm pretty sure I will pick up the PDF just to have a look at it.
Well, it says here, choose among 12 entities, including Hastur the Unspeakable One and Cthulhu the Great Dreamer, both of whom, in traditional Cthulhu sense, are kind of immortal and unbeatable. Each with its own attributes and powers, and each player will have to pursue unique and disturbing purposes.
So I'm thinking it's kind of like a series of one shots. I mean, obviously, being eternal ancient ones, they can destroy and remake the universe multiple times. So I'd like to think that every session is how do we destroy the universe, or who gets to destroy the universe and remake it in their own image this time, I think. But we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I'd do it in the one roll engine before I start unpacking your zero engine to do it.
Yeah.
It's one of those ones you kind of feel you do it in the amber dice list system or something like that, rather than something that, you know, limits you to a dice pool. Even though dice pools can get pretty big in Year Zero, I can't quite see how it works here. I mean, what sort of gear bonus do we add to?
I'm just trying to have a look and trying to get a sense. It almost feels, and I could be completely wrong because this is the first time I've looked at the Kickstarter. It feels like there's like board game elements in the same time as it's, you know, claiming, you know, it's presenting itself as a role playing game, where you perform actions on the scenario map, players will fight for the control of the setting. Can destroy your cities.
And you see, there's Cthulhu Wars. If I want plastic miniatures of Cthulhu, then Cthulhu Wars is the way to go.
Yeah, or Cobalt Cthulhu, if you wanted a Roman version.
Yeah. Well, if we start listing all the games that have got a theme around Cthulhu,
we'll be here all night. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yes.
So shall we, in fact, close the world of gaming for this episode? Look, we're already 42 minutes in.
Yeah,
do you want to
yeah.
listen to what I've discovered about critical hit tables in normal Year Zero games? Let's wait and see what the critical hit table is in Elder Mythos.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It'll be, yeah, 1 to 66, or 11 to 66, dead.
Everything's instant. Dead.
Okay, let's test your critical thinking.
A few weeks ago, we were talking on the cast about critical hits in Year Zero games. We have taken a slightly different approach in Tales of the Old West, so I thought it might be fun to compare the critical tables of all Free League's Year Zero games. My assumption is that they were, or are, all pretty much the same. But are any more deadly or more lenient than others? How have they developed over time? Is there anything that we can, at this late stage, actually learn? Now, first of all, some broad standardizations for comparison. We will find, as we explore these tables, that there are some results that require you to roll up a new character, or, if it's your birthday, get so red in the face that your GM takes pity on you. I'll call these insta-kills. Then there are some results that are lethal unless the character concerned receives treatment, a successful heal, medtech or medikurgy or whatever the name is it's called in that particular game. For the purpose of this comparison, we're going to call these healing save results. The rest, the ones that don't kill you, we'll call non-lethal results. It's also worth mentioning that most, but as we shall see, not all of the tables follow the same D66 format, which means, of course, just 36 results. These tables, then, will be the easiest to compare, but we can compare all the tables, even the non-conventional ones, by working out the odds of insta-kills, healing saves, and non-lethal results. The granddaddy of Year Zero engine games is Mutant Year Zero. Now, I don't have that game, but I do have Genlab Alpha, and I'm reliably informed, thanks Dave, that the tables in Mutant and Elysium are the same. So, in these games, you get an insta-death on 65 and 66, which makes it a 1 in 18 chance. There is a 1 in 3 chance of needing a healing save to avoid death. And let's just be clear that 1 in 3 chance means 12 results out of the 36. Note that 4 of these have a negative 1 modifier to the healing roll. There are 2 results, which is, I guess, another 1 in 18 chance, that cause paralysis, which can be permanent, if not cured, within 4d6 days. It's worth pointing out that the time limits to prevent death with lethal wounds are shorter than the recovery period, which I guess makes sense. While the recovery period is always measured in a random number of days, the window to save a character's life in this table can be as short as d6 hours, minutes, or turns. The very first game to be adapted from the Year Zero engine is Coriolis, the Third Horizon, and it starts off with a big difference from its predecessor, and in fact, most of its later stablemates. Critical hits can be bought with extra successes on your attack roll. Mutant, and in fact, most of the Year Zero engine games, only dole out the crits when a character is broken. Another difference with Coriolis is that it takes longer to break a character. The other games use the strength stat as hit points or a similar number of conditions before breaking. But because Coriolis totals hit points from both physical stats, it takes roughly twice as long to break a character. So most players look to take their opponents down with a critical hit. This results in a sometimes game-breaking behaviour that we have in the past dubbed crit farming. But we are not discussing crit farming here. We are here to look at the chance of death or lethal injury. Coriolis has the same 1 in 18 chance of insta-kill as Year Zero, and interestingly, no paralysis results. Indeed, we don't see much more paralysis from here on in. But lethal injuries requiring a healing save are much more common. There are 17, which makes it pretty much a more than 50-50 chance that death is on the line. And seven of them, fractions are hard. That's a bit more than one in six, almost one in five, come with a penalty to Medicurgy rolls. Is this the deadliest Year Zero engine game? Not by a long chalk. Yes, the crits can be bought before a character is broken, but the characters in the Third Horizon have lots of high-tech armour to choose from. Let's see if we can rank the remaining Year Zero games to work out the deadliest. Not in the running is Tales from the Loop, where kids can't die, or Things from the Flood, where it is possible to die, but that's a narrative choice. The closest game to these two, which does have a critical injury table, is Versen. Versen has no insta-kill criticals. Like Coriolis, the Third Horizon, 17 results will require treatment to prevent death, but none of the treatment has a negative modifier. So Versen might be the least deadly game that qualifies for the pool. Death. Pool. However, it bids to be one of the cruelest. One result that leaps out is, on the roll of 45, a mortal injury, if not treated within 1d6 days, of crushed genitals. My first thought is that they must be pretty severely crushed to be deadly. And my second is, isn't it a pretty patricentric description? And maybe a crushed pelvis would be better. One unusual bonus in Versen is, if the crit is serious enough, 61 to 66, you might get an insight, which is a once per session bonus, +3 or even +4 on a particular skill. It's worth mentioning that Versen also has mental crits, 36 of them. None of them are deadly, but 17 can be permanent if not treated within the time limit. Forbidden Lands has not one, but three critical injuries tables for slashing, stabbing, and blunt force weapons. As an old Rollmaster hand, I think it's a good compromise to the heady old days of a critical hit table for every single different weapon. But how deadly are these compared to other games and to each other? The first thing to note, even though each one is a D66 table, is that there are roughly half as many different injuries in each. You get a slit throat, for example, on a roll of 63 or 64. The top two insta-kill results, 65 and 66, are separated out, so there's still a 1 in 18 chance of instant death, but there are only 19 results on the table, two of which are instant kills, 7 requiring a healing roll to prevent death, and 10 non-lethal injuries. 10 out of 19 means that you have over a 50% chance of a non-lethal injury, and that is for slashing wounds. Blunt force is even easier to survive. There are 14 non-lethal injuries. 1 in 18 chance of insta-death from a crushed skull on 65 or 66. 64 gets you a broken neck, which won't kill you, but will leave you paralyzed if not healed. There are just three other health save injuries spread over six results, giving you a 1 in 6 chance of getting one of those. Stabbing is rightly a little more deadly. An insta-kill here on 64, 65 and 66, making it a 1 in 12 chance. 6 health save spread over 9 results, a 1 in 4 chance of getting one of those, and just 8 non-lethal injuries. We shouldn't forget the horror table, which can give you some very Call of Cthulhu-like mental conditions, but luckily most of them are only temporary. Horror can kill you, though. Roll a 66, and you are dead of a heart attack. Twilight 2000 is very different. It starts with a roll on a D6 hit location die. That gives you a 50-50 chance of being hit in the torso and a 1 in 6 chance of being hit in each of the head, the arms or the leg. Not very realistic, I agree. All RuneQuest players know that the most likely place to be hit is the left leg. And then there is a D10 table for each of those four locations. And a 10 on the head or torso table means insta-kill. I think that makes it a 1 in 15 chance. And you only have a 24% chance of getting away with a non-lethal injury. Next highest in the deadliest crit stakes is Alien. 4 results on the D66 table are insta-kills, which makes death a 1 in 9 chance. There are only 10 health save results, 6 of them, 1 in 6, with a penalty on the saving roll. The Walking Dead also has a 1 in 9 chance of an insta-kill and a 1 in 3 chance of non-lethal injury, which means over 50% chance of getting lethal injuries and needing a healing save. But it's worse than that. Of the 20 healing save injuries, 9 require advanced medical equipment. If you can't find it within the time limit, you can't even attempt to make the healing roll. And the penalties for healing rolls on some of the injuries go as high as -4 or -5, which makes The Walking Dead more deadly than Alien. But the most deadly Year Zero game is Blade Runner. Blade Runner mixes things up again. There are 2 tables for crushing or piercing damage, and each has results up to 12. But there is a complication. Different weapons have differing crit dice. Some roll a D12, but sonic rounds, for example, only do a D6 crits, which makes them essentially non-lethal. In a nice abstraction of complex realities, blunt melee weapons generally have a critical die equal to the strength of the attacker. But with these complications, what are your chances of deadly wounds and insta-kills? A decent D12 crit projectile weapon is what makes Blade Runner the deadliest of all the Year Zero games. Insta-kill results happen on 8, 10 and 12, meaning a 1 in 4 chance. There are 5 healing roll lethal injuries and 4 non-lethal injuries. Crashing injuries are generally less deadly. Only a 12 is an insta-kill. And there are 3 other lethal results depending on healing saves. Let's briefly finish with Coriolis the Great Dark. I'm not counting this in the league table because it's an unfinished game. But here are some observations about the critical table in the quick start. First, here are 2 paralyzed results, a callback to Mutant, but only 1 instant kill. And there are only 6 healing save results, just 2 with a negative modifier. At the lower end of the table, the less serious injuries are fewer in number, but each covers 2 results. Overall, for the game based in part on the novel The Terror, this looks quite like a gentle critical injury table. But be warned, we've already seen changes between the two different versions of the quick start, so it might get more deadly. See what I mean about unfinished?
Okay, cool. That was an interesting kind of statistical run-through of Free League crits. It's interesting. I mean, there's a wide range of potential death. I was thinking as I was listening to that, how does that compare to ours in Tales of the Old West?
And, that's kind of why I did it anyway.
Yeah, which is a good thing. Because I think with Tales of the Old West, I think we've got a couple of insta-kills, but only a couple, mm-hmm. two, I think.
Yep, we have only got a couple.
We've got one that's almost an insta-kill, where you're going to die in rounds, and that might be as short as one round, unless you get medical aid, which, if you roll a one on that d6, that might be equivalent of an insta-kill. You then have, including that one, you have nine or ten, as you call them, heal crits.
Heal saves,
and then the rest. Yeah. But I think the thing, so it doesn't feel that deadly.
So that's no.
Two. That's one in 18 chance of an instant death, and usually when you get the opportunity to make a roll to save somebody, somebody comes to your rescue and they usually make the roll. They usually succeed.
Yeah.
But I think the thing I've found with both playing and running Tales of the Old West is the fear in a player of the critical hit table is what makes it powerful. The fear that, oh my God, this is almost a certain death sentence, when actually it's not.
It's
a risk.
Not, no.
It's a terrible risk. You know, I wouldn't want to put my life on a 1 to 18 chance, you know, at any point in you know, ever. But I think the fear is great because people really worry. And for me as a GM, when I call a crit, I worry. But actually the occasions where that crit kills somebody are quite few and far between, which is probably right. I think probably good.
Yeah. So, we ought to explain to listeners who aren't at this point, privileged or stationary patrons who don't have a copy of the quick start rules, at least in their hands, that we're trying to combine the hit location stuff a little bit that we saw in the Twilight 2000 version with the standard 36 table. So your tens indicates the area you're being hit on, and your units indicates the severity of the wound.
I'd like to point out that I came up with that crit table long before Twilight 2000 came
well,
out.
And so the only issue I'm going to take you there is we came up with that.
It was a parallel development.
Yeah,
between us and Free League.
We did it first, and frankly, they probably saw this crit table well before they were doing Twilight 2000.
But when I mentioned it in an email to Thomas, his response was, "Great minds think alike," is what you said.
No, so you're right. I remember that.
So
yes.
I assume he was obviously thinking something similar for Twilight 2000. At the same time that we were putting this together for Tales of the Old West.
We were doing that. Exactly, yeah. So there are things that I think make Tales of the Old West feel a bit more deadly than it actually is, because it's about the same level of deadliness as Coriolis. So the first two games, Coriolis and Mutant Year Zero. But I think it feels a little bit more deadly because there's no armor in our game.
No, indeed.
And there are called shots in our game.
Yes.
Although we've just, after playtesting, we've changed the penalties on that, so that may be a bit different. And also there are elective crits, so you can spend extra successes on crits, which in the Year Zero engine only happens, as far as I can see, in Coriolis.
Yeah. And I like that. You know, you mentioned crypt farming in your piece. Mm-hmm. We've had conversations about crypt farming. Now, I think the term is wrong for me, because crypt farming is a pejorative term, I think. It implies that it's a bad thing. And actually, I don't think it is. And particularly maybe in a Wild West setting where you don't have armor. And if you got shot with a gun, you know, you're not going to shrug it off. It is going to hurt, you know. And I think, you know, the risk of getting a crit is really important. And actually, in a gunfight in the Wild West, you want to put your enemy down in one shot, because they then can't shoot back at you. So I think it makes absolute sense.
Absolutely. I am absolutely convinced it is right for the genre.
Mm.
And I don't think it's crypt farming. So I think some of the things about crypt farming we've dealt with. So I think, can we agree that when we talk about crypt farming, we're talking about pushing the roll to get more successes so that you get more rolls of the crit table and choose the most deadly roll? Kind of how I think about that.
Yeah.
And so we started out in this game in playtest, you know, there was a version a bit like that where you could roll multiple times on the crit table and then choose the best one. We've actually got rid of that. So yes, you do get spend more successes on a crit, then the crit is more serious, but it isn't by just rolling two or three times and choosing the best one.
No, because
so that I think is the element of crit farming that we've actually got rid of and improved.
Because that basically completely broke the immersion. It's like, do I want to shoot him in the shoulder or in the foot or in the arm? Or that?
Yeah.
No, that just really destroyed the whole ambience of the moment. So now, any extra successes, you get a bonus on your units die. On our table, because we're doing it by location, the units die is the one you've really got to worry about. Okay, it's not good to be hit in the head. But if you roll a one on the units and you get hit in the head, it's a minor crit. If you get a six on any of your locations, that's going to be a bad hit on the units die. So you gain extra pips on your unit die if you get extra successes over and above those you need to cause the crit in the first place, which is great. And you just roll once and take what you get. And it works much better. It really works much better.
Yeah.
But interesting, going back to your piece and coming away from Tales of the Old West for a moment, interesting that they kind of chose Blade Runner to be the most deadly. You would think that taking those, that list of games, you would have either maybe Twilight 2000 or Walking Dead would be the game where you'd want death to be more obvious.
And were it not for Blade Runner, it would be Walking Dead that walks away with the top prize.
It was interesting. I had a game of Walking Dead last week or week before that I'm running with my Wednesday group, and we nearly had a TPK. Very, very close. It could have gone horribly, horribly wrong. One of them was killed. One of them got a serious wound that he had to fix himself in the end. But that was the first death. And I was saying at the beginning of the game, I haven't killed anybody yet. This is what's going on. This is The Walking Dead. And at one moment, it looked like it could have been the whole team was going to get killed. But it was great. Great fun. But it felt very
actually,
deadly.
I want to call on your experience with this game. Do you notice in the Year Zero, what am I saying? In the Walking Dead game, in that table, there is a result for coma.
I'm just getting the book down.
Excellent. Well done. So this is a result that is lethal, it says. But it also says you can't make a healing roll. So we notice in Walking Dead that there are some pretty severe penalties on healing rolls. Half the healing rolls, or a bit less than half the healing rolls, require advanced equipment, which I think is great for this game about, a collapse in society. So if you haven't got a hospital and all the stuff you need in a hospital, then you can't save somebody from dying. But one of the ones you can't save somebody from dying in, well, for different reasons, is coma. So there it says it is deadly, but instead of having an A or a B, it just says cannot take action.
Cannot act.
I don't I looked through the rest of the rules and I couldn't see what that really meant.
I wonder if that's a typo, because it doesn't make sense on that column. That column is the penalty that you get as a player if you're trying to save that person's life.
And some of the penalties are pretty serious in this game. You know, you can get a -5.
That's really quite grim. I don't know. I think if I'd got that result in the game as the GM, I would probably ignore that and give them a negative to trying to save their life.
My only thought was, is it? So, again, going back to, and in fact, I think I remember something else I want to talk about a bit. Going back to zero.
Is penalty here, sorry just for that, is penalty here the penalty that you get as a player for having suffered that critical injury, rather than the penalty to the person trying to save you?
We might be touching on something here. You've played the game. I was imagining that isn't an action penalty, but you might be right. But I do remember that they make very clear in the earlier games, if you aren't broken, or obviously generally you only get one of these crits when you're broken, but you also recover, you know, either somebody gives you a point or you recover a point over time anyway. So when you become unbroken, they specify in a lot of the games, and yes, you can treat yourself for one of these injuries, but obviously you can't if you're in a coma. So does it actually mean there's no negative for that?
No. I think what it is, I'm just having a quick look here. So it's not super clear, but it says the GM rolls a die for recovery time secretly. You won't know how long it takes. The table states if recovery time, forget about that. When the recovery time is passed, the penalty is removed. So that it doesn't talk about penalties before that I can see, but that strongly implies that is a dice penalty to your character. And obviously that makes sense with a coma, because if you're in a coma, you don't get a minus on your actions. You just can't act because you're in a coma. So it then says, if you're attended to by someone who uses basic medical gear to make a medicine roll, recovery time could be shortened. So I think the time limit is how, again, it's not super clear. The time limit is how quickly you've got to act in order to save that person's life with a medicine roll. And the recovery time can be shortened with another medical roll. I'm thinking. That's the way I'd probably run it. But it's not super clear. The other thing you were in the middle of saying something and I interrupted. Sorry. If you remember what it was you were saying.
I don't think I can. I guess what we should... I know you've been doing it, but maybe we should bring in Douglas, our patron, who's been running this a lot. He may well have encountered this issue already, because he's playing with a whole bunch of kids of school age. He runs a school group, and they thoroughly enjoy the walking
around. So
some of them might be knocked into a coma. We should check with him and see how he done that one.
So the interesting thing I was going to just come on to next, just looking at Walking Dead. So your piece is all about critical injuries and about how deadly, which is the deadliest game. Did you, I'm not sure you did you include the deadliness of the walker attacks in The Walking Dead? Because a walker attack can also be instant death. And there's quite a lot of them.
Even touching on the crit table at all.
Know. Absolutely. So let's take a look. So certainly 54 onwards to 66 are all death sentences. Some of them are instant, some of them take time. And I think some of them...
There's another D66 table, is there?
So when you take a walker... when you take a walker attack, if you mess up, for example, or if you're fighting a swarm and you fail your roll, you will then suffer a walker attack. So you roll on this D66 table and you basically take the result that comes out of it. And it was rolling on this table that killed Connor's character a couple of weeks ago.
Whoa. So what then triggers a crit? Because I haven't played Walking Dead at all.
So triggering a crit, quits. Let me try again. Put my teeth back in. Crits are triggered when you are broken. In Walking Dead. Yeah.
So, actually, then maybe Walking Dead is, as a whole, the most deadly game.
Mm. Because
even the though walker attack, crits are more deadly in Blade Runner.
Yeah. But the walker attacks bypass crits completely. They can just kill you in one swipe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's cool, though. It was cool. It was a good death. Right in front of his brother. Who was the one who then got seriously injured. He got criticaled and nearly bled out from a leg wound.
Brilliant. Yeah, cool. Brilliant.
No, good. Good article. That was excellent. I mean, a couple of other things. I mean, One important thing that comes into all of this is kind of how you manage time in those terms. And we've obviously done our own thing. I mean, not particularly changed at all, no, but done our own thing for Tales of the Old West.
We have made clear the difference between the different measures of time, haven't we? We started off conflict with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, is there... Are there differences in the earlier years in Zero Games?
So I one of the things that struck me, particularly in the early games, is I don't feel Freely could kind of got their terminology right, or right. You know, had or sorted set. Their terminology yeah. out. So when you look at how long you have to make the healing save that may save somebody's life, we're talking about days, we're talking about minutes, and we're talking about turns. Mm. Now, when I looked at that, I thought, well, that's weird, because 1d6 turns is much longer than 1d6 minutes. But I think their turns in Year Zero, in Mutant Year Zero, are more like rounds in the later games. And, you know, we've kind of scrapped a minute. So now very often we talk about a day, a shift, a turn, and a turn might be like 15 minutes if in Alien, for example, as you're if you're searching a space or something like that, that could be up to 15 minutes. And then when we're in combat, we're talking about rounds. But I think probably I haven't played enough or any Mutant Year Zero or any of the derivatives, actually, I'm just realizing, to understand that. But looking at it, I went, well, that's weird. But then I thought, oh no, do they mean combat round? And I think I'd live with that. So it's interesting how that sort of terminology has developed over time, and
it's standardized.
We've got a little table in there to kind of talk about that as well.
I mean, in some respects, I like the idea of saying, you know, a round is, you know, 5 to 10 seconds. A turn is 5 to 10 minutes. You know, a shift is, you know, 5 to 10 hours. But then when you say you've got 4 shifts in a day, well, it's not 5 or 7.
You haven't got 40
or 10 hours, is it? It's 6 hours. So, and it's it doesn't really matter, actually, I think. But it's just an interesting little kind of thing that I noticed whilst we were doing Tales of the Old West, that kind of a, not an inconsistency, it was just a different way of trying to put it together. On the one hand, you're trying to be loose and allow the GM to make their round and their turn as long as they want it to be, or as short as they want it to be. But then on the other hand, your shift in the way we're doing it, or the way it's, you know, we've done in things like Forbidden Lands, is 6 hours. You know, there is no...
You know, that has just alerted me to a bit of a typo, I think. This is exciting news for those of us who listen. Now, when we are recovering... not critical injuries, when we are recovering
just stat damage,
quicks, or from our shakes or from our hurts, it's 1 point a turn, isn't it?
Yes.
But in our table, we talk about the shift. One of the main reasons for measuring shifts is recovery.
Yes, I thought that, actually, because that doesn't really make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
Actually, the shift is much more about things like manhunting and tracking.
Yeah.
Or travel.
Or longer tasks. Yeah. Know. Yeah. We need to change that word, I think.
Yeah. Is that in the quick start?
In the quick start. That's in the quick start, yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Bloody hell, you see?
Game design on the fly. That's what, that's what we do.
Well, the other thing I just briefly wanted, coming back to Tales of the Old West, and I think we've had the, I know we've had this discussion before, but I just want to revisit it. That in a lot of West, in a lot of the genre, in fiction in the genre, wounds, of course, in this time before penicillin and antibiotics, and, you know, what's a potentially sterile environments. Wounds can actually be a lot more damaging and in the long term more debilitating or even more deadly than we are giving them credit for in our critical injury table. Yeah. I just briefly wanted to return to that and say, have we made the right decision there? We made a decision. It's one of those not fun rules that we decided to make it more fun by being less realistic. But I just... given that range of deadliness that we've now seen in the other games, how do we feel about that, Dave?
So I think certainly for the quick draw, we leave it as it is. I don't think we should be trying to make any changes to that right now. So I'm a bit torn between, yes, you're absolutely right. At that time, getting a bit of dirty metal put through your leg, you know, the disease is as likely to kill you as the wound is.
Yeah.
So we've got the realism, I guess, of it against the how much fun is it to play somebody with gangrene or sepsis?
Yeah. Or, I mean, I just wanted to say, in my character in the last game that we podcast got a gut shot, and in that was treated, luckily, with a slightly hand-wavy role at the end of the adventure. I only say that because I've been editing it recently. And it just made me think, you know, does a gut shot actually really write a character out of the game? Is what I was thinking doing this one. So, but that would definitely be unfun. I don't want to be playing the next adventure, you know, lying on my bed like Harrison Ford in 1923, which is a very interesting Western TV series that I can recommend on Paramount. But he spends a lot of the time recovering from being shot.
And now that obviously would be more realistic, but how much fun is it?
How much fun?
I mean, I wonder, one of the things that we could suggest to manage this, if GMs are thinking, oh God, I wish I could have them getting diseased after they got shot, is use the turn of the season roles to dictate that. And it could be on that table, you know, a personal fortune could be you're ill. The GM can then, I think one of them is you suffer an illness and it deals with it. You know, it might linger on a bit, but it deals with it kind of within that phase of the game, the turn of the season. But we could then say to the GM, give some advice that, you know, this could be a festering wound or you know, something else of that ilk. And then leave it to the GM to decide how they want to play in the disease. I had this conversation with Gabe Garcia when we were doing War Stories. And it was a very similar conversation. Gabe was saying, but diseases, they were really common and it was a real problem. And even though you've had, you know, sort of nascent...
and penicillin.
Antibiotics and stuff, yeah.
It was a new technology at the time. It was,
exactly, yeah. It was kind of the first time it was used in any great sense. But again, actually, how much fun is it playing a soldier who's now struggling with gangrene or sepsis?
Yeah.
And we put the rules in, but again, I think similarly with a... this is an optional rule, you know. I mean, I was of a mind of saying, you know, let's not bother because it doesn't really add to the fun very much. Gabe wanted to add that additional level of reality, so or realism, so the rules are in there. But again, in a hands-off, this is up to you, GM. If you want to use this, great. If you don't, forget it. I think maybe something similar for Toto would fit the bill.
Yeah. One interesting thing I spotted, just to finish this whole discussion off, is there's a little box out in the Year Zero, in the Mutant Year Zero games that say, oh, this may take you, you may not enjoy rolling on this crit table and you may want to simplify it, and this is how you simplify it, which is, broadly speaking, take whatever they call the make, if you get broken, make a death save, essentially.
Right.
And I think, I as I say, I've never played those rules. I don't remember it being in Coriolis, but I have to say, in play, in our experience, crit rolls have never felt too complex for us or too game-breakery, except in that, as we mentioned, that point where you're rolling three or four times and deciding which crit you want to deliver in Coriolis. The crit table is lovely. It's lovely. I really enjoy it.
And as a GM, you know, I'm quite circumspect and careful about when I force a crit on a player, because it's a real moment of life and death tension,
drama,
and often I'll say to the players, you know, oh, I'm really sorry, but I think I'm going to have to crit you on this one, because the circumstances or the fight is so important, or the bad guy is such an important enemy they've got to fight. But it's great. It works. And the players always go, yeah, no, I get it. And then they pick the dice up and roll to see what happens.
No, they make you roll because you're the GM. If anybody's going to kill me, it's going to be the GM that does.
Well,
I'm not rolling my own death.
I always offer it to the players. If they want to roll their own dice roll, they can. But I'll roll it if they want me to. So you get a variety. But I think the way crits work, and the, like I said earlier, the fear of, oh, shit, there's a crit coming on you, against the likelihood of it being instantly killing you or killing you, that there is a lot more fear than there is real risk of death. And that's brilliant.
Yeah.
But also, the other way around, when you're critting somebody else as a player, there's a lot more, oh yeah, this is going to be epic. I'm going to put this bad man down with one shot, against the, oh, I've hit him in the foot kind of thing.
Yes.
But it builds that moment. It builds that excitement. And I think it works really well. I think we've kind of got the balance pretty good.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Cool. Well, we've banged on quite a bit again today, haven't we? Is it about time to end the Tales of the Old West show? this podcast is becoming a bit of us just talking about Tales of the Old West. But
we're thinking about it a lot. We promise that. Shall we do something different next week? Next episode in 2 weeks' time.
Okay, what do you suggest?
I have no idea.
Okay, we'll think of something.
This is my bit of homework. It's your turn to think of something.
Okay, I'll have a think. But yeah, okay, cool. But for now, thank you for listening, everybody. And it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
And may the icons bless your adventures.
You have been listening to The Effect podcast, presented by Fiction Suit and the RPG Gods. Music, Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing.